Welcome to Insight Out, a podcast from Ipsos UU that explores emerging trends, budding innovations, fresh thoughts, and creative ways to get closer to real people in real life. Each episode features thought-provoking conversations showcasing industry-leading thinking from the Ipsos Global Network of Insight Specialists. I'm April Jeffries, and I'm your host of today's episode of Insight Out. Today we'll be speaking with Oliver Sweet, the head of our Ethnography Center of Excellence in the UK. Ollie and I will be talking about how culture influences and impacts some of the drastic changes and transformations that are currently playing out across the globe. Ollie, welcome to Inside Out.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. Pleased to be here.
So, Ollie, I have just been really eager to talk to you as all of this COVID-19 has played out, and you, I know, are an expert on culture, and having looked at culture through the lens of ethnography and anthropology and all that, I've been really eager to just see, you know, what your take is on sort of what's going on here and how we might be able to get some sense of better understanding what's going on here and how it affects ourselves and our businesses.
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, that's very kind of you to call me an expert on culture. I lead an ethnography team, who are obviously a group of cultural experts, but I'm the only one in it who's not an anthropologist. So I'm constantly taking the mick out of for not having a good cultural understanding. But what I would say is important is actually being a translator for what's going on in culture. So we're actually trying to use principles of anthropology and cultural theory, but also trying to apply them to the real world today so everyone can understand them. A lot of people try and decode it, and I think there's two broad big buckets of how people decode it. So these are the different behaviors that we exhibit. It's about sort of being a group and how you express yourself as a group, and it's kind of how you belong. It's got behavioral elements, it's got symbolic elements. And then you've got this thing which is kind of fast culture, which is culture that's consumed, which is stuff you see on Broadway or things that advertisers put out. And a lot of ad agencies call themselves culture creators, actually. Mm-hmm. And politics is part of culture as well. And the two are linked, but they kind of bounce off each other a bit. So how a group identifies with themselves comes out in fast culture, but then sort of gets recycled back into slow culture.
So wait, let's back up for a minute. So it's similar to, you know, Ipsos has this paper that they published called Signals, and they talk about how there's these macro changes, right? Which sounds like the slow culture you're talking about, right? Things that happen over time and become part of, you know, the broader thing. And then there's these smaller signals, they say, right, that influence the macro, but that happen kind of quickly. So is that a similar kind of pattern that you're talking about here? Like the fast things influence the slow, and then the slow influences the fast?
Absolutely. Same thing? Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we've seen a big cultural shift in over the years, over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, is the way that people treat food and how they eat. And we are seeing this sort of more conscientious health coming out, where people are wanting to save the planet through their food, so sourcing locally, not eating too much meat. And then, you know, one of those signals is that you see a big chain bakery called Greggs in the UK, which is selling baked pastries and bread at cheaper prices possible to often to people who love meat, now serving vegan sausage rolls. So, mm-hmm. So that is a very good signal that the macro trends have shifted, and mm-hmm. that they now see that they can sell vegan sausage rolls.
Yeah. So some of those things are pretty obvious, but the other thing that happened in that signals report was because of COVID-19, it's like we're bombarded now with all these smaller signals that then need to figure out which ones are going to stick and which ones are going to move on.
Yeah, and that is really the thing that we're all trying to look at the moment, because there are all these signals coming out, and you know, as a team, we've been watching the pandemic develop with a lot of interest, and we've been working on a syndicated study the whole way through, and we're constantly trying to figure out what our participants are telling us and showing us that might be of huge interest. And you know, one of the things that we certainly saw in the US, this absolute disparity in the mortality rate of African Americans. On the surface of it, that could be seen as something that was, you know, a description around genetics, but it wasn't. It was a symbol around inequality, and that's something that's existed within the US for some time, and then just came out more and more and more. And in a report we wrote, we said we are worried about the level of inequality amongst the African American community. And then George Floyd happened and came to the fore, and we've seen the protests and the subsequent actions there. So these things, you know, cracks that we've had in society are fast becoming chasms. And we've seen that we're seeing the same thing happen in the UK. Our biggest problem is probably the division between what we call in the UK the people and the elites.
Well, two things. One, we talked about this chasm, right? And you know, we could go into economic theories for sure, but there's clearly something that happens when that gap between the quote unquote haves and have nots gets too big, right? And how that plays out in various cultures is obviously different, but clearly the gap is what drives some kind of different behavior. Yeah.
Yeah. No, for sure.
But in the UK, it's interesting because the time I've spent in the UK, I remember a colleague of ours, Sue Phillips, told me we were talking about someone, one of your leaders there in the UK, and she was saying how he's so good at just making sure everybody gets the right level of credit for what they've done. And so it's never about him, this particular leader, but it's always about his people. And she said they call it the poppy syndrome, the tallest poppy mm-hmm. syndrome, where no one wants to be the tallest poppy in the UK. So that sounded like a cultural thing to me as we get back to this discussion on culture. Like in that case, no one wants to be the person who sticks out, whereas maybe in the US, it's a little bit different.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly how it works. That's exactly how it works. If you stand out, then, but it's interesting because there is an implicit understanding, and I probably shouldn't say this, but like if you write a congratulatory email or you make a congratulatory comment that certain people have done incredibly well, it is genuinely a moment of saying thank you and well done, but it's also there's some sort of inferred congratulatory note onto yourself because you haven't actually said, oh, I did this. It's saying someone else did this, and I kind of oversaw that as well, you know, and
I'm speaking
exactly speaking, and that's how British class system works. This is the way culture works. It's subtle in a slow way, but then it's less subtle in a fast way when it comes out.
Interesting. That is, and it's such a great example of what you just described. That makes perfect sense to me. But so now with COVID, you know, we've talked about how it sort of throws everything up in the air, right? And it changes everything. Talk to me a little bit about what's been, you know, totally revamped now or not.
Well, it's, I mean, COVID has done many things around the world in terms of kind of big realizations, but there's a few key things that I think it's done, both in terms of insight and in terms of methods and in terms of kind of culture. I mean, the one thing it's reminded us of is that we as human beings, as a human race, we are fundamentally social people. So we have a crisis. What did we do? We huddled together. You know, in the UK, everybody's got a WhatsApp group for their street, and they're starting to share shopping. And okay, that's a nice kind of middle class example from a nice well-to-do neighborhood, but everybody is suddenly so much more localized and actually quite creative and actually quite giving. people were very giving because they wanted to be social. They wanted to get together and help one another. No matter how many Zoom calls we went on, digital connections just weren't enough. And fundamentally, we just wanted to go and give our mum a hug and just say, it's all going to be okay. So as a kind of human race, we've realized what it is to be close to people, which I think is fantastic, you know.
Well, and it's interesting because how you're close to people, though, differs by culture, right? Like, so a lot of times I do webinars and I'll start the webinar with, you know, what's the first thing you're going to do when the lockdown is over, right? And depending on the country that I'm talking to, or frankly, even the group of people that I'm talking to, that answer can range from, I'm going to go hug my mother, to, you know, I'm going to go to my favorite restaurant, which is where I normally do my connecting, right? So I hear you, it's true, but I think this notion of culture plays out even in that way, like how we are social beings and how it plays out.
Yeah. And we that's what we're looking for. We're looking for some security right now. And actually, that, you know, whether it's going to hug your mom, whether it's sitting in your favorite restaurant and having those old times, whether it's, you know, seeing people or being in a particular place, we are being very nostalgic about the things that we used to do. And I think if you say, you know, this question of what are you going to do when you come out of lockdown is a wonderful question, because it just takes people back to their kind of cozy place and their happy place. But herein lies the problem, in that a pandemic is not clear cut. So I think that we're all hoping for this moment. We all suddenly start dancing down the street and everyone pours out of the houses and we hug each other and, you know, there's confetti in the air and it all seems like a wonderful party, but it's not. And here's where culture is really going to be tested, because we are going to be let out of lockdown sort of small piece by small piece. And we are starting to see some of the stresses and strains that have been put on society that we've kind of put a sticking plaster over coming out. And that's proving sort of the issue, I think. And there's this wonderful kind of cultural comparison you can do about how confident you need to be about the future. So there's an uncertainty index that's one of the Hofstede measures. It's called uncertainty avoidance, and you get certain countries that basically are fairly happy waking up in the morning, kind of not knowing what's going to happen and just playing it by ear. That doesn't stress them out too much. There's other countries that really, really don't like uncertainty. You know, they like to know what's going to happen that day, that week, that month. And that's hugely important for how you communicate with people. So if you're imagining like things like tone of voice and, you know, messages that you throw out to people for the moment after lockdown, you know, some countries are desperate for some kind of certainty. Others, you know, quite happy to be a bit opportunistic and play it by ear a bit.
So what does that mean then for brands and for businesses?
It's a good question, really. It means that, so I think as the world is shutting down its borders, let's put it that way, we are seeing the rise of national culture coming back. I mean, for the last 20 years, people have been moaning the fact that the national culture is being eroded by globalization. And actually, I think we're about to start missing globalization. You're like, what? I can't just buy that instantly and it rise right now. I think there's a, and you see brands, actually, the brands that seem to be winning are the ones who are having quite a national play, if you like. So now your brand really needs to stand for something that your nation stands for. What are the national qualities that are coming to the fore that you can harness within your brand?
So it's the whole think globally, act locally.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. And I guess the only way to know how to do that is you know, based on what you do, is to really kind of get in there and understand what those local things are, right? Which is another form of culture.
Yeah, no, that's you really do need to understand what's going on locally in order to make that nuance, I think. I think this idea of how do you connect to people on a very local level, and this is what we've tried to do a little bit in terms of methodology, because I think it's, you know, we're living in a world where we can't research people face to face, but we don't necessarily want to shut off the importance of that kind of face-to-face insight, because everybody who's a researcher knows that, you know, when you're in a focus group, when you're in an interview, when you're doing ethnography with people, you read people, and that's mm-hmm. how you get a lot of your insight. Interestingly, actually, the mask is proving quite an interesting phenomenon, because wearing a mask over your face means you can't necessarily read people. And you've got different kinds of masks going on now to try and showcase who you are as a person. So you might have like a medical mask, which sort of indicates that you need clinical protection, and you really buy into this idea that we're under threat. And then you get these kind of stylized masks, kind of cool, some of them kind of floral design coming out that kind of shows that you're part of a tribe, or just like you're part of a fashion tribe. You're going along with the flow because you believe that wearing a mask is good, but actually showing who you are is a bit more important. And then no mask. Okay, now you're pretty ballsy here, right? You're going to walk out into potentially, you know, a disease war zone and say, I don't need a mask. I'm that tough guy. You know, and it's kind of interesting how people show their personality through a mask or not wearing a mask.
That is really interesting. And I was talking about this the other day with my daughter. We were in the supermarket. It's like, you know, you can't see people smiling anymore. So there's a whole nother thing that's happening on the real estate of a face that just you have to kind of readjust to how to read it and what it means. And, you know, there's a whole nother messaging thing that's going on.
And I think that brands and anyone in some kind of service industry or whenever you're meeting people, so any brand or organization that is going back into any kind of face-to-face capacity is going to, the first thing they have to do is they have to demonstrate safety for their staff, safety for their customers, safety for everyone. But that's going to be kind of table stakes. Everybody's going to have to do that. And everyone's going to do it well. I'm sure everyone's going to do that well. The other thing you need to do is demonstrate kind of opportunity and desire there as well. So if you imagine that everyone's got this kind of medical clinical mask on, and you put signs up saying, you know, stay 2 meters apart and don't touch this and don't touch that. Where's the fun? Where's the desire? Like, if you want someone to come back into McDonald's, I think they're going to have to think very carefully about the masks that workers wear. Because that's going to, it's all signals. These are all signaling off to people. So these are the associations that people are going to be having.
Yeah. Well, and even as a researcher, right? So as we, and that's another question I have for you. So do you think that, I mean, we've moved a lot of things to online and to video and things like that. Do you think that that's a permanent shift, or do you think that we'll be hungry to really be, you know, quote unquote, face to face with people again as this?
I think it's a semi-permanent shift. I think some stuff will go online and stay online, and there's some stuff that you just can't get insight on based on just not meeting people. So, you know, I've been an ethnographer for 12 years, going into people's homes, meeting people. And what I'm trying to do at the moment is get people to show me around their home, their life as much as possible. And whereas before I would take, you know, 6 or 7 hours to do it, now I'm going to take 6, 7, 8, 9 days to do it, because I want people to video every part of their life for me so that I can try and do a similar level of analysis based on the context of their lives. Now, the thing we're getting to is I can actually get some pretty good insight into their aesthetics. I can get some pretty good insight into their priorities in life. I can get some pretty good insight into what they are trying to signal to the rest of the world about who they are. But I don't ever fundamentally understand them as a person, as an individual. And there is this issue of time with a person that allows us to understand their own contradictions that they have in the world and kind of almost play that back to them. You know, there are so many times where we've been out into people's homes to interview them, and at the end of the interview, after 7 or 8 hours we've spent with them during that day, they suddenly tell us something they've never told anyone else in the world. They've literally never told anyone else in the world, because they are able to open up and they are able to do that. You know, we've had people crying in their car after they've told us how wonderful their car is, and to say that their car is actually just, it's just, you know, a toy because their partner isn't interested in them anymore, or someone telling us about how their work has taken over in such a way that, you know, it's controlled them rather than them controlling it. And all of these are hugely important in terms of, you know, if you're selling cars or you're selling computers. But I don't know whether we ever get that online.
Well, and they're also, you know, people are also showing you to some extent what they want you to see, right? As opposed to your point, building a real relationship over a, you know, extended period of time. I think it does get to some different insights for sure. So you talk about being an ethnographer, and you said earlier on in this conversation that you kind of came at it differently than the rest of your team. Talk to me a little bit about how you come at ethnography, and, you know, where did all this come from, and who are you that we should be listening to? What
I ask myself that question all the time. I think that really clever ideas have to be communicated in a way so that everyone can understand them. And if everyone can't understand them, then you don't understand it perfectly yourself. And I've got lots of people, all the people in my team have either got masters or doctorates in anthropology or sociology or other things like that. But the world of academia can concentrate on itself a little bit too much. So they've got some fantastic ideas in academia. You know, these guys are some of the smartest people around, but they need to learn how to tell other people about them. So that's been my quest over the years, is to try and be a translator of clever people to the rest of the world.
Okay, so I'm gonna, because I realize you're trying not to be the tallest puppy in the room right now, I'm gonna just throw this out for you to consider, because I've known you now for a couple of years as part of the team, and I think what you bring is this wonderful perspective on telling a story, which might be what you're trying to say, but you're an awesome storyteller, so you can take all of this data, which is often, you know, observational data, and create a story that's engaging and that lets you feel insights, and as opposed to trying to tell people what they are. And that's, you know, that's my plug for you today, Ollie. You've been recognized quite often for that skill. So yes, I know, I'm sorry if I made your poppy a little tall today, but I felt that you weren't doing
No, that's probably fair. That's probably fair.
So thank you so much for joining us. This has been a really, really wonderful and relevant and timely conversation. Yeah,
pleasure.
So
thank you. Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you everyone for tuning into this episode of Insight Out. Be sure to hit subscribe on your latest podcasting app to make sure that you'll get all of our latest episodes delivered directly to you.